This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Madeleine Ryan is an Australian writer, director, and author. Her articles and essays have appeared in SBS, The Daily Telegraph, The Sydney Morning Herald, Vice, Bustle, Lenny Letter, and The New York Times. A Room Called Earth is her debut novel, and she is currently working on the screen adaptation. Madeleine lives in rural Victoria. Welcome, Madeleine, to the show.
Thank you for having me, Catherine.
Let's start at the very beginning. Have you always been a writer?
Wow. In a way, that's such a simple question, but it's such a multifaceted question because I think on like a soul level, yes. But whether I was writing or in what form I was writing constantly has changed throughout my life. I was born into a family where both my parents were journalists and, well, critics. My dad's a film critic and my mum's a television critic. And so the house was filled with books and they were constantly writing. But I became convinced that I was an actress, probably because on some level I wanted to be the thing that they were watching, you know, or something.
As oh, that is
being
very,
an only child like, wasn't
Freudian
enough.
Yeah. Or something, isn't it?
I know, I think it is. But I was very set on being an actress for a really long time. But at the same, on the same token, I was constantly journaling. And like as a little kid, I would be writing stories and creating picture books full with like, yeah, full color pictures. Words that I'd perfect, you know, to the best of my ability. So it's like that was always there, but I became very sure that no, I was meant to be an actor. I did a lot of theater. I also studied acting. But again, at uni, I found myself doing all the creative writing and literature subjects because they didn't have exams. So I was like, yay, I'll do those because it was about writing essays and all of that. I mean, I still found that really challenging. It took me a long time to finish that uni degree, but I did, and I was studying acting at the same time. And then I kind of got to a point after having done acting and I was doing all these different jobs, like I'd had so many different sorts of jobs, that I was like, you know, writing actually feels easy. Like there's something about it that brings me great relief. What if I just, you know, start writing articles a lot like my parents? And it was like, being like my parents, what? No, I'm not, surely not. And I'm like, well, maybe I can write about different things from them, but, you know, I can give it a try because it flows. And so then I started writing articles. And then, yeah, this, the kind of the voice, the protagonist of this book sort of started speaking to me and I started writing out that. And it was like, whoa, it felt like it was on a whole nother level from writing articles. It was a very different like muscle or a discipline in my life that had to be kind of cultivated in a different way again. And so it was this constant process of, yeah, unfoldment. But that's why it's like a multifaceted question, because I think on some deeper level it's like, yes, I always have been, but on like a physical surface level I've explored lots of different things and was denying that or using that in different ways kind of throughout my life. So yeah.
So for A Room Called Earth, what did the actual writing of it look like? It sounds like it was a little bit more organic. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's definitely fair to say. I, at the same time though, I'm actually, it probably doesn't look like, it's not, I, yeah. It was planned in that I knew where it needed to go. Like I knew the start and quite quickly I knew where it needed to end as a story. But how I got there or how I was led there, was sort of open. And then it was about every day finding a way to discipline myself to create space for the world of the book to just kind of talk to me and to like engage with it. And because I was writing articles, there's a very addictive quality to that kind of writing because it's tied in with the media, of course. So it's got this like, yeah, hectic sort of frenetic energy that's like, you know, I pitch an idea and who's going to take it and what are they going to say about it and how much money might I get and then when will they publish it and then you get this hit when they run it and will my partner's photographs go with it. And it was like this kind of instant thing, whereas writing the novel was like I was just in the abyss with this world, and my own imagination, I suppose, but also, yeah, the voice of the protagonist was very particular to me and very kind of readily accessible somehow. And I mean, I'd been through a lot of changes in my life in addition to writing that I think kind of allowed her to speak to me and be as clear as she was. So I had faith that I would get from what I imagined to be the start to what became the end. So in some senses it was like something that was planned or prepared for, but not entirely consciously. A lot of my answers are going to be like this. They're going to be like, well, on one level, yes, but on one level, no. So that's kind of the space I exist in. But yeah, so planned, but not planned.
The book takes place across, it's interesting you say you knew where it began and you knew where it ended, because the book takes place across a pretty condensed time period. It occurs over Christmas Eve Eve, which I feel like is a really underrated day. Like it's a real day that people know, yep, but is kind of underacknowledged.
It is, because it's this strange sort of point before, you know, yeah, the proceedings begin, which is kind of where the story begins. You know, she's preparing for a party. It's like we're preparing, and the day is very much the preparation for the party that is Christmas, I guess, or whatever. So yeah, it's a funny zone. Yeah, underappreciated, as you say.
Were there challenges working in such a condensed time period? And then, I mean, consequently, there were place constraints, I imagine, as well.
Yeah, there weren't, actually. This is probably an answer I can give more clearly and definitely, but there weren't, because I just followed where it felt right to kind of go, and it never felt constraining. It was like, every moment it was like, okay, well, what is she seeing? What is she feeling? What is she thinking? What's happening? And then once again, what is she seeing? What is she feeling? What is she thinking? Where is her attention in this moment and in this moment? Occasionally it was kind of like, look, do we need to go into another kind of time? Do you want to go to next week? Do you want to go to the next? And it was just like, no. It was like my whole being just said, no, she just wants to be here moment by moment. And so I'd follow her, and inevitably when, you know, you're in the present moment, or I found when I was in her mind in any given moment, she could be reflecting on the past. It's amazing how the past is like with us in the present moment, and our projections into the future are with us in the present moment. So it becomes a very kind of multifaceted experience to be present, and that enabled it, I think, to become quite, yeah, alive and expansive, even though it is technically only 24 hours. So, yeah.
I think that's really true, that fluidity of the present. One thing that's interesting about the book, it, as we've sort of said, this, you know, sort of a stretch of getting ready for a party and then going to a house party. There's also a fair amount of social commentary within it. So, for example, the protagonist sort of critiques colonization and its impacts on Aboriginal people, talks to their connection to country and land. Why was it important to you to include this?
Well, because she thinks about that. She was very considerate of those things. I mean, I guess me as the writer felt it made sense in terms of like, well, this book is called A Room Called Earth. It's about her psyche and her connection with her life, but also the earth and the place that she inhabits. But it also made sense when she started going into it, it felt like, well, she's kind of, I guess, alone in lots of ways and feels alone in lots of ways. And then I find, at least in my life, when I've felt that way, my connection to the things around me, whether, even if they're not people, becomes way more vivid. So if it's the earth that I'm sitting on or it's the animals that I'm surrounded by, they take on this whole new meaning and I engage with them much more intensely than, I mean, I wonder if a lot of people have been through this in the last couple of years, but it's like, it's sort of like her investment in her space and then coming to understand, well, how did the space that I'm living in become this space? What's the history of it? What does it mean? And how do I relate to its identity alongside my own? And how do those things entwine? I mean, it sort of made sense that she would be thinking about that and wanting to engage with that, I suppose. So, but there were dimensions to it, because then, yeah, I was sort of sitting back as the writer being like, yeah, that feels right that she would go there, and I want it to be a part of it, because part of being on the earth and being, I guess, a white person on the earth it is potentially accepting the history of the earth that you're on and what was a part of that, and then trying to figure out that kind of awkward, guilt-ridden relationship with that, but also feeling like, well, I was born here, you know, and I can't deny that. How do I reconcile those different aspects of who I am and where I am? And I think she does certainly reach in her thinking quite a beautiful, like, humane, universal sense of connectedness with the trauma, but also the beauty of being here. So, yeah, there were lots of different things that she explores, though, as you say, like the social commentary that comes into her awareness. But it was always assessing whether or not it was like, you know, I have a document of like, I think it's like 60,000 words of stuff that sort of came out, but then just didn't fit because it's like, no, that wouldn't be on her mind, or that's not in her awareness, or that's just me bitching about someone I went to school with, like loosely veiled as something she'd be thinking about right now, but that doesn't feel accurate. You know, I'm just indulging myself there. You know, so there's a lot of that exists kind of behind the scenes as well. But yeah.
It's interesting you talk about that as in some ways creating connection, because even though she's alone at times and there's so much that's interior, it feels celebratory in some ways of aloneness. Like, it doesn't feel lonely.
Yeah, totally.
I was going to say, I wondered if that is something that you had thought about, that state of alone, not having to be, feel like a deficit.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. She was very, I guess, empowering to me and liberating to me because of her relationship with when she's, you know, technically alone but never feels alone. You know, I think that's like, I very much admire that capacity in her and would love to be able to cultivate that, you know, myself in my own life. I think if we could all cultivate a sense of kind of connectedness with everything and everyone around us at all times, whether they're a close friend or a family member or a neighbor or some, you know, it's like that can totally liberate us, I think, when our sense of connection isn't conditional on things going a certain way or people being a certain way or people always being there, because people come and go. You know, that's like that's like a reality of being on the planet that can be, you know, full of grief and full of lots of challenges. But to see that we're also all beyond our comings and goings, I think, is incredibly powerful. And she, yeah, was a total sort of advocate and someone, well, not even an advocate, because she just embodied this sense of like being alive, being enough, you know, and feeling things and seeing things and thinking about things, just being completely sacred and like something to honor and to celebrate. And I'd love to think that people reading it can kind of come into contact with that too, because it was so kind of, yeah, liberating to write that feeling.
Madeline, you were diagnosed as autistic while writing A Room Called Earth. What impact did that have on the writing of the book?
Yeah, it was all very separate initially. Like, I was about 6 months into writing the book at the point where the official diagnosis sort of happened, and I'd had like a breakdown in communication with my family. And during that, well, we could actually rewind like about 5 years before that, I met these beautiful women when I was at acting school, and I would spend every weekend with them and sort of sit on the couch, and we'd light candles and eat these beautiful snacks and dark chocolate and just talk for hours. And I found myself for the first time being able to sort of communicate with people like that, and was like, wow, usually I'm so drained after spending this much time having to sort of talk and engage and whatever, but for some reason I don't feel tired. And I shared this with them, and one of them sort of said to me, look, Madeline, it might be because you're autistic like we are. And I was like, what? And I didn't know how to compute that at all. And then fast forward, I think it was, yeah, it must have been 4 or 5 years, I can't even remember now, I had this breakdown in communication with my parents, and it was totally to do, I think, with like social expectations or the way that something needed to be handled socially, or I don't even know. And we were in such different spaces with it. And I just said to them, look, the reason I might be wired differently with this is because I could be like autistic, you know? And they were like, what? You could be what? Like, is it like, are you? And I was like, yeah, like that's like, maybe that's a thing. And then it sort of cracked open my whole sense of self and identity. And with them, we all went through the diagnostic assessment process, which is quite like grueling. I mean, it's probably changed, hopefully, in ways by now. But then that was like this incredible rite of passage, and I started writing articles at the same time, sort of as a way to, I think, process that. But it all started to make sense. And I mean, I'd been in and out of therapy for like a decade, having all sorts of diagnostics being thrown at me to sort of explain all the different things I was experiencing. But then when autism came into it, it just, everything kind of just gently fell into place in my understanding of myself on this whole other level. And for my family, I think too, that was very helpful. But then that was sort of all happening independently as I was writing the book. And then, yeah, so after the assessment and all of that, I was like, it must have been 3 or 4 months afterwards, and I'd kept writing and just following where the protagonist wanted to go. And I was like sitting outside having a cup of tea or coffee and like thinking like, well, you know, if I'm inside the protagonist's mind in this book, if the whole book is inside her mind and it's the way that she thinks and processes sensations, conversations, people, stimulus, and I'm using how, like, the mechanism for how I do that and applying it to her. And if my mechanism, I'm being told, is autistic or neurodiverse, does that mean she is? And all of a sudden.
Interesting question.
I know. And I was like, oh, yes. Like, how could it not be? Like, and all of a sudden, I felt this connection to her on this whole other level. And this sense of her place in like society at this time, I suppose, or, and her identity that felt like, I felt like relieved, but also very special. It was like she'd chosen me for that reason, but to sort of reveal the beauty of that way of being that I think is deeply misunderstood. And I, and her as a vehicle for that was like, whoa, that's massive. But then, you know, it was also, it brought a lot of conflict in, because by that time I was aware that she never liked to use labels. Like, even though she explores a lot of things that could be, you know, seen as mysticism or feminism or colonialism or, you know, veganism, it's like she would never use those words. She would just be describing what she likes to eat or like how she looks at her body in the mirror and what her body like means to her. It wouldn't, she wouldn't label anything. So it was like, well, she's not going to use the word autism. Like, I know that. But then when it came to how to describe her to the world at this time, it was like, oh my God, do I use the word? Do I not use the word? What does it mean? All the stigma. Oh my goodness. How is it going to, you know, how is it going to go? And I think the best place in the end for it to exist was definitely, you know, me being comfortable being the neurodiverse author and saying, yes, she is. But that the book, at least the Australian version now, and the UK versions don't have it mentioned that she is. It's just that it comes from a neurodiverse mind. And I like that, but there's no question that she's neurodiverse. But that relationship with the label and with labels right now is also very interesting to me and was a challenging and sort of illuminating part of the process of writing it and having it published, for sure.
So the book also came out, or has come out, in North America. Is that right? In Canada and
yeah,
the US?
Yeah, in Canada, yeah.
So does that mean they were more explicit within the text about that labelling of autism?
Autistic? They were. And we had, I mean, it was my choice though. They were very much like, look, we're going to be guided by you, you know, and I was conflicted because I had some people sort of around sort of saying how important it was for her to be labelled and how much it was needed. And I totally appreciated that and understood that, and it made sense. And the first run of the book that they've done, it does say on the jacket that she's autistic. And, you know, it's correct. It's not incorrect. But I'm also conscious that I think that could potentially alienate a lot of readers that might not pick it up because of that, you know. And that's just a reality. Like, even though that, you know, ideally everybody wants to pick up every kind of book, but I mean, you know, that's not the case. We all have preferences and we all have ideas about what certain words mean or what they bring to them. And I feel like it probably, yeah, meant that some people wouldn't pick it up. Whereas if they just didn't know, but they saw a description that was just connecting with the themes of the book that I kind of see as in a sense more important, but there are lots of different parts of it that are important to focus on. But yeah, and that is one of them. But yeah, I'm happy that the Australian and UK versions don't. That came a bit later. Like, I got to go through the American experience, grappling with it, and then coming out the other side being like, oh, it's probably better to not have it there at all, you know.
So did it come out in the States before it came out here?
Yeah.
Ah, yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. It came out in August 2020 in the US and Canada, and then in March here and in January in the UK. Yeah.
Right. And so where was the book originally sold? Like, what was the pathway to publication?
Yeah, a lot of like strange sort of stars colliding and all kinds of things. But I was writing articles for American publications, and I had some literary agents from America contact me, sort of being like, oh, you know, are you working on a book? Like, we'd love to see what you're working on. But yeah, they just emailed me sort of through my website and said, like, we'd love to see what you're working on. And I was like, okay, well, when I'm finished, you know. I mean, it was very tempting to just show them where I was at, but I was like, no, I'm gonna keep it with me, and I'm gonna finish it and then share it. And I think there was about four of them who contacted me. And I was feeling all like excited, and like it almost gave me something interesting to work toward, though, knowing that it had somewhere to go, I think.
It's incredible. Even not, like,
I know, it was nice. But at the same time, when I got to that point, you know, I excitedly kind of sent it to them, and one of them was on maternity leave. One never got back to me, and one of them had too many people on her books, and one of them just was like, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know where this lives. And we kind of went through this like revision process a little bit. She did actually help the story, I think, with her feedback, or at least I was able to use some of the things she said that helped, but she still just didn't take it on. So I was like back at,
oh, that's crushing,
square one. And I was like, oh my God, it is literally back to the submissions page after I was all puffed up, because it's like all these like American literary agents like want it, like they're so interested. And then I was like, oh my God, wow. It was very, very humbling. But it did open up my thinking to like, well, maybe I can be contacting agents in the US. Like, I hadn't really thought about that. If they hadn't have contacted me, I'd probably have not considered, you know, the world when it came to who do I go to work with on it. But it was back to the submissions page. And I think for a few months, it was just praying and emailing and praying and emailing.
So cold emails, like,
yeah,
as in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Slush pile just, style.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And doing, you know, I remember seeing a tweet from an author in the US being like, after 5 years and 700 emails, my book is finally being published. And I was like, whoa, okay. Whoa. Like, that is not going to be me. That is not going to be me. Like, I bless your journey. I am so glad that you got there and that it took that long, but God, please, like, universe, whatever you are, like, no, this is going to be different. Like, this is going to be okay. Something else is going to happen for me and be my story. Oh my God. And it was like, but it was, you know, I kept having to think, okay, does anything need to change with the story itself? Like, I'd get feedback from the occasional agents too, who were rejecting it, being like, you know, didn't like this or did like this. And it was like, okay, do I change it? Do I not? Is that useful? Is it not? And all of it sort of strengthened my resolve about the story and how it was. Like, either I would change something or I would be like, no, it's right as it is. There's actually nothing more for me to do at this point. Like, I just have to trust, because it feels as full as it can be in most ways.
Like that zone of feedback, trust. Like, they're such a hard decisions to make.
Yeah.
And they're very lonely decisions at that like, you make them, they're very gut-based decisions.
You've got to have a finely tuned like intuition, I think, to sense what is correct for the soul of the work and what's not, you know, because then the rest is sort of semantics. Like, I'm very interested in like the energy underneath the words and making sure that that's like preserved. And I think I learned that a lot through writing articles as well, because often the needs of like a publication can be very stifling and very like, oh, like soul crushing. But it was like, how do I keep the essence of what I'm trying to say, even if I have to sort of play this game about what's needed? It's like, how to, and I mean, I love that part of the creative challenge too, but then I think there's only one article I ever wrote that I know got way too skewed towards something that wasn't even what I meant. And it was like, oh man, I really regret that. That can be very heartbreaking when that happens, to like watch yourself be pushed too far away from where you kind of knew it needed to be. I'd already been through that as well. So it was like I had all these different experiences to help kind of steer me through the darkness and the abyss that it was. And then it was just, yeah, one night I'd emailed this woman and she happened to get back straight away and started reading and was like, you know, amazing. Like, yeah, I'll take it. Let's do it. Oh my God. You know, off we go. And it was like, whoa, okay, fabulous. And then, yeah, she sent it to different publishers and pretty quickly the two that were right for it resonated with it and it kind of fell into place. So, and that was over the course of a few like months.
Was she based in the US or was she based?
Yes, she was in New York. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You have talked in different articles online about having astro style and tarot goddess open on your computer, seeing a psychic, having crystals. I can see a lava lamp in your backdrop.
There's a salt lamp and a lava lamp just to keep it like even. Keep it real. Have both.
Tell me about the role that these kinds of things play in your life.
Yeah, a pretty big role. I mean, my life has been such a sort of mix of things because as I described earlier, you know, my parents were intellectuals and like journalists. And so I grew up around, you know, newspapers and cups of tea every morning and, you know, nobody was meditating. Nobody was, you know, working with tarot cards or doing any of that. That was something that I sort of cultivated for myself. And I also went to like a non-denominational school. Even though my dad is like a lapsed Catholic and my mom is Jewish, it was like they, I think, chose to sort of put me in a system where I could cultivate a sense of spirituality if I wanted to, or religion even, if I was drawn to that. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, actually. It's interesting that you sort of ask, because I think over time, and perhaps in part because I often found connecting with other people could be challenging. This wasn't conscious, but I think I was naturally drawn to like, okay, there has to be something more than this communication difficulty. There has to be something more than this relationship coming in and out of my life, or this going badly, or this rejection, or this being misunderstood, or not meeting this criteria. Like, God, please. I mean, not God. I mean, whatever it is, you know, something, speak to me beyond these things, because I don't know why I'm here. If this is all that it is, because this is bleak. This is some bleak stuff that I would go through, whether it was at uni or in relationships or sexually or whatever it was. And it was like, I think a deeper part of me was really yearning for a sense of something bigger, and finding things like tarot and, you know, connecting more with, yeah, that intuitive part of who I am, as distinct from just the intellectual part of who I am, and has been a massive part of my life, and is something that sort of transcends, yeah, whether people come in and out or certain roles that I play or jobs that I have come and go. It's like this sense of, I guess, a connection with spirit, which I think is kind of difficult now if you weren't brought up with it, or to kind of cultivate, because there's so many distractions. It's so easy to get sort of sucked into other things. A sense of something bigger is something you do have to consciously connect with and cultivate, but it's really helped me for sure.
Can you think of a time that it sort of changed the direction you were headed to ask tarot cards or to see a psychic?
I use them a lot. Like, and I go to an astrologer and a shaman and a psychic kind of like, you know, around my birthday each year. It's like a gift I sort of give to myself to connect. And, you know, these people, like with anything, come with all of their stuff too. They're still human beings, but there's often like information I can glean or a sense of direction that can really resonate. Often if you've had a good reading or a good card reading or whatever it is, it's something you already knew on a deeper level that you're being told. And being aligned with that, I think, is very powerful to actually, I use cards a lot, like throughout the week, I'm using them when it comes to different decisions about how to handle things. And often what I find I see in the cards is something I already knew. And then it's like just committing to that, or it helps sort of push me into that more. And I found them really helpful for that reason. And they're beautiful. Like the cards themselves are so like gorgeous to work with and to look at. And it's really just a reflection of my own thinking and wisdom anyway. I mean, I probably prefer working with it on my own than I do going to readers too often. I like, you know, I've found people that I trust, but I think the relationship that I have with it just myself personally has been the most powerful part of that to help me get to know myself more than anything else really, but also a sense of something more and a sense of aliveness that's
'cause you can,
multifaceted.
I always get freaked out with the, like, that I will get bad news.
Yeah.
Does that, like, do you find that daunting or you just see that as a hurdle in a, or that knowing allows you to avoid a potential problem or conflict?
That, definitely. But again, it's always things that you knew, but it's also your interpretation. It's like people always get freaked out. There are cards in the tarot, like the Death card and the Tower card, which look very sort of cataclysmic and frightening. But sometimes, like, because I've spent sort of years working with them now, they can indicate things that are incredibly positive. Like death is also rebirth, and it can just be a really profound change, but that you already know that you're kind of going through and you're able to then sort of, oh, I find I can surrender more into it, having that confirmation, like, oh, yeah, I sensed that that was falling away. Oh, that's a relief. I can relax into that change and know that that's the direction I'm meant to be going or whatever. So it is about your interpretation, and it just takes time to sort of develop a relationship with the cards and what they represent, you know, and I've had time to do that. But that first, I mean, when I first started using them, oh, yeah, I'd had this, like, a horrible experience where I'd gotten a really bad burn on my leg on this plane flight, and I ended up sort of in my room in this share house, not sort of leaving for like a month. And I started exploring the cards. I must have been like 20. I mean, actually, before that time, I'd been told that I might be interested in these by a psychic, which funnily enough, but I hadn't. It always takes me a bit of time to get to things. And anyway. Yeah, so I was on my own and I started developing a relationship with it, and then, yeah, it just blossomed from there. But getting to know it yourself is probably, like, if anyone listening or if you were to start doing that, they'd probably seem less scary. Sometimes when you go to someone else, you're also being faced with their judgments and their opinions and their interpretation of the cards. And then if you become too susceptible to that, it's like, well, wait a second. There's lots of different ways to interpret this card, like what feels right for me, without totally distorting the sentiment. Like, you know, when you get the Death card, it is the Death card, you know. So embracing that or figuring out what that means for you is, you know, can be very liberating.
Madeline, you're one of the few writers I think I've interviewed for this show that is not on social media. Have you ever been on it? We've talked about tweets and Twitter.
Yeah, I do. I look on Twitter, but through the search engine or whatever, like I'll look up Twitter or people's Twitter feeds and sort of read them, but I don't have a Twitter. I did have a Facebook back in the day. I think I was on it for a while, deleted it, was on it again, and then deleted it back in, like, it must have been like 2016 or something. I last deleted it and I haven't had it since. And I had a LinkedIn for a bit. But then, yeah, that's it. I've never been on Instagram or Twitter or anything like that. And to be honest, I don't think we'd be talking about a book if I had stayed on those things. I found, like, when I was on them, my creative energy or my attention was torn in so many different directions, and whatever social issues I was having were just amplified. That's not everyone. I mean, when I speak to people, other people on the spectrum, some people feel really, or they say that they find it easier to sort of communicate through those platforms because there's such a kind of, there's a formula, you know, and it's like clear or something. But I find it still very confusing and overwhelming, and I could just feel myself kind of being crushed and overwhelmed too much. Strange. So to, yeah, clear that away was a huge part of, I think, what led to the book being here, because I went through all these changes in my life around the time where the sort of protagonist started, like, speaking to me, it felt like. And one of those changes was, yeah, I think the last time I deleted Facebook and then just never went back. And Yeah, and I certainly don't regret it. It's been a very helpful space to have created in my life.
Does it, because sometimes those social media in general can be great for building a writing community. How have you built a community of writers around yourself? Or do you have a writing community?
Do I have it? Well, you know, I've developed relationships with the people that have been working on the book, or that have worked on the book, I suppose, and I really value those. And I guess I decided that writing articles and having those shared was my way of creating a network around me, and how I wanted to reach people was through a news story in their feed rather than through having my own profile. I sort of created this like whole web that made sense to me through that. So I, you know, and I developed relationships with the editors that I would be writing stories for and whatever. So there was that. But it, I mean, in my life in general, it's like I have relationships with people who I'm working with creatively. I mean, I think that could be a slightly autistic thing or just maybe a very human thing. I mean, I have a belief that autistic people are like the heightened needs and sensitivities of everybody else, but it's just they're like amplified by 10 or by 100. And I find that my creative life is where I create relationships with people anyway. But whether I have like, I don't have like a group of writers that I sort of sit around and talk with or workshop things with, that's not been something that I've been drawn to for some reason. I mean, it's just been, well, if I'm working with you, then we have a relationship. You know, if you're doing the cover of the book or if you're editing the book or if, you know, I'm brainstorming with you about whatever section of it, it's like then that's how the community would be created. And the same with the articles I was writing. It wasn't sort of like a something that existed just in and of itself, like a workshopping environment with other writers. I mean, I don't think I could ever do that, to be honest. I mean, people that idea really intimidates me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a really nice explanation of an alternate way of building a community, though, through articles is another avenue to do that. And I saw, you know, on your website, you have a newsletter is another way of.
Oh, yeah, I have a newsletter. Yeah, a sort of seasonal newsletter for sure. But I mean, the condition of all of that, though, is that you do have to have kind of faith in what you have to say or what you have to write. Mm. Like that has to be the foundation of all of that. And if you're struggling with that, then I can see why maybe creating a more workshoppy social environment with other writers might be a place to start. Or that could topple you completely, I'm not sure. But yeah, I had to develop that faith and then the community came. Mm.
We have a lot of writers that listen to this show and we always like to get advice either about writing or about the head game that's being a writer. Madeline, do you have any pearls of wisdom?
You know, I often think about what I'll say when I'm asked like this. I don't often think about it, yes. But like, you know, I have thought, and I think the most valuable thing I can say is nothing. And I hope that can be helped. The spaciousness or the silence can be the best piece of advice I can give.
I think that's good. Do you have any, in your own writing life, is there one thing, a book or a person or a moment that you think was particularly helpful? Or was it something like that, like trusting in yourself?
Yeah, it's got to be that mainly. I read a lot of fiction growing up and a lot of literature growing up, so no doubt that has influenced my conscious and unconscious minds and my writing. But in the last sort of 10 years or so, reading self-help books that sort of kept pointing me inward, or psychology books or spirituality books that enabled me to go within, was the greatest key to my imagination and to myself and my soul, I think, that then enabled me to create the a world, you know, that is the book. So I don't know, I guess there's not been one particular author or one particular thing. It was like a choice that I made to like go inward and to listen.
Now, normally we finish on a reading recommendation for a debut author, but I have already flagged this question with you and you said similarly that your tastes are very idiosyncratic. Can you recommend a book for our listeners Doesn't have to be a debut author. What is your best self-help book?
My best self-help book. Oh man, it's so hard because they all speak to different needs or different things. I guess. Look, no, I'll branch out. Probably the writer and the energy and the person that has resonated with me most across reading all the self-help that I have and all the literature that I have is probably Oscar Wilde and any of Oscar Wilde's books and works. I find that his writing incidentally is kind of like self-help or like a sort of has a liberated but intellectual but very spiritual outlook that unlocked a sense of anything is possible probably in me when I was very young, but still does. Like I still read his essays and different sort of plays that he's written, and I find his work has all the different dimensions to it that I'd love my own work to have, but also that I think can be very nourishing on all different levels. So that's probably what I would say. And yeah, I'm terrible. I get probably in a similar way as I feel like I can't sit necessarily with a group of writers and just be social or workshop my work. I struggle with reading other debut authors. I feel very intimidated by that, and I'm incredible at copying and mimicking. And I have, you know, that's a technique that I've used throughout my whole life to sort of fit in. And so the pull to do that when I see someone else has written something a certain way to be like, oh, I can just like emulate that immediately. It's like I've had to learn how to turn off that impulse. And so I sort of steered myself away from it. So yeah, that must be another reason why that idea of the workshopping was just like, oh no, I don't think that's for me, because I'll just start being like everybody else or a mix of everybody else rather than sort of listening. So yeah, that's how I have to answer that, I guess.
I think that is a wonderful note to end on.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.